Now we're coming tonight to look at our third judge. So I don't know if you can remember, there should be a slide coming up now, just to remind us of the judges that we have considered so far. And I can't see the slides. I've got it written down on a sheet of paper. So the first cycle, remember the repeated cycle in the book, the children of Israel, they went away from God. God gave them into the hand of the enemy, and that caused the children of Israel to cry to the Lord, and the Lord heard their cry and provided a deliverer, a judge. And as long as that judge lived, the children of Israel dwelt in safety. But once the judge died, the cycle began all over again. The children of Israel forsook the Lord, etc. And the first cycle, we saw God provided Othniel as the judge. And then the second cycle was Ehud. And during that second cycle, there was a minor judge. The third judge was the one we looked at last time, who was called Shamgar. And during Ehud's judgeship, it was from the east that the enemy, the Moabites, attacked. And then towards the end of Ehud's time, a new enemy, the Philistines, were coming, not from the east this time, but from the west. And he was able to defeat that enemy. So now we're coming to the third cycle, and this is the fourth judge that we are going to look at. But before we look at the judge, let's look first at the enemy. Remember what we learned last time? The enemy doesn't attack in the same way, doesn't come to us from the same direction. I posed a question last time. Now, some of you were expecting me to answer it, but I didn't do that on purpose. I was asking the question, where today is the enemy, the devil, and his demons attacking the church? And I think that's an important question for us to ask, because we shouldn't be fighting yesterday's battles today. We've got to have an understanding of the times that we are in. It's always the same enemy, the world, the flesh, and the devil. But when we're thinking of the devil, especially, he is going to have his battlefronts in different places. He will sometimes come as an angel of light. He will at other times come as a roaring lion. And in this instance, I think it is right to say that he comes as a lion. So the attack now is not from the west, and it's not from the east. It's coming from the north. So if you look at chapter 4, we're told that after Ehud died, here's the cycle beginning, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. There's nothing new about sin. The Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Now, Hazor was a city in the territory of Naphtali, so that was north of Galilee, about, I think, about 40 or so miles north of Galilee. And Joshua had destroyed that city, but by now it had been rebuilt again. And this king, Jabin, had his enforcer. That's why I'm saying the attack this time was very severe. It was fierce. And this enforcer was called Sisera. You come across him in verse 2, the second half of the verse. The commander of his army was Sisera. And they had all the resources, the enemy, as they often do. We, as the Lord's people, are always in the minority, and it seems as if those who are against us are far greater in number. And this time, it was 900 iron chariots, and the poor children of Israel were under oppression for 20 years. 20 years. And in the song, Deborah's song, that follows in chapter 5, we're just given a few more details about how bad things had got during this oppression. So look at verses 6 and 7 of chapter 5. It was already happening in the days of Shamgar, but now it was getting worse. The second half of verse 6 of chapter 5, the highways were deserted and the travelers walked along the byways. That means that the main thoroughfares were not being used because people were afraid of being attacked. And they were just taking the more scenic routes that were more hidden. It was a sad state of affairs. And then it is highlighted in verse 8 of the Song of Deborah. There was no shield, the second half of verse 8, nor spear among 40,000 in Israel. They were weaponless, defenseless. And does it not seem like that with us today as Christians? It's the world that has the numbers and the resources, and we seem so exposed, so pathetic in the face of such opposition. And then a very sad phrase is used in verse 20 of the song, or maybe it's further down. It's verse 30, second, about halfway down, not quite the second half. Are they not finding and dividing the spoil to every man a girl or two? For Sisera, plunder of dyed garments. The enemy was plundering the people's goods. They were plundering their daughters, which means they were raping their daughters. It was a dreadful time. We're also told that village life had ceased in Israel. People were afraid to go out because of what might happen to them. Does it sound familiar? We're told, aren't we, that a few generations ago, children would feel safe to go out and to play. We read of the nostalgia of summers in days gone by, where when children would roam freely, whereas now we're much more afraid for our children. So here were the children of Israel under oppression for 20 years from this northern king, Jael, and his fierce enforcer, Sisera. Now, I need to ask the question at this point, why did this happen? I know the children of Israel were turning away from the Lord, so he gave them over to the enemy to bring them to their senses. But there's something very significant here about the attack coming from where it came. If you look at chapter 1 of Judges, we're given some interesting details there. Chapter 1, verse 33. This is the tribe of Naphtali. This is where Jael came from. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants, but they dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. God commanded the children of Israel to destroy the enemy, but they didn't do that. They allowed them to remain in the land. And I think a little later we're told they used them for slave labor. But the point is this: they did not utterly obliterate the enemy. Now, we are good, sound Christians, and we are not interpreting these battles in the Old Testament in a literal sense in our Christian life. It's the spiritual battle here that we are learning about. And what lesson we've got here from the attack coming from the north is this. We need to take care that we, in the words of Paul in Romans 8, verse 13, we mortify by the Spirit, not in our own strength, by the Holy Spirit, the deeds of the flesh, so that we shall live. Are we a bit like the children of Israel in the days of Deborah and Barak? Are we tolerating certain sins? Maybe we're saying it's only a little one. It's different times today. Are we giving a foothold, as it were, to the enemy? Let me just give you some New Testament references here, because I think this will help us. So just like the children of Israel were pilgrims, sojourners, travelers, so are we. And Peter, chapter 2, verse 11, puts it like this. I beg you, here's a pastor speaking, an experienced pastor, and dare I say, it's a pastor who knew his own heart. He wasn't getting at his people. He knew from bitter experience what it was to fall into sin and what it was to weep bitterly as a result. And so he's saying from his heart to his flock, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Now, the word for abstain means avoid at all costs. Don't even give an inch to those lusts. Notice what he's saying. Don't give a foothold to those fleshly lusts that war against the soul. Paul puts it in Romans, make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust thereof. That was the problem with the children of Israel. They hadn't mortified all the enemy. They had allowed them to live. Now, to me, this speaks about us looking at our hearts. John Flavel, the Puritan, has got an excellent book, and it's got the title, Keeping the Hearts. We've got to watch that no hazors, which may have been mortified, are not rebuilt again. We've got to watch that there are no jails rearing their ugly heads and no scissors. Let me read Galatians chapter 5. Notice now, we're not thinking first of the actions that are wrong. Those actions come from a wrong attitude. And this is what we're thinking of, the intentions of the heart. We've got to nip it in the bud. We've got to keep a guard on our inclinations. So let me just go through this list. We're familiar with it, I'm sure. The Apostle Paul goes through the fruits of the Spirit, and he contrasts them with the fruit of the flesh. These are the lusts, Galatians 5:19. The works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery. All right, we say, we're not guilty of that. But hang on, fornication. Don't we sometimes have unclean thoughts? And he goes on to mention that. Thirdly, uncleanness. What do? We stop it. What did Mr. Hyam used to say? It's often the second look that we have towards somebody. And it is so easy today with what we've got on the internet. It's the second look that's often lustful. The first look can be a look of admiration, but the second look, that is what gives the foothold. And then it's not just in that area. Lewdness, yes, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath. How do they begin? They often begin inside of us. We nurse a grudge against another Christian. They may have said something that we took the wrong way. And instead of forgiving them, we just nurse it and we go over and over it. And it starts to grow inside of us like a spiritual cancer. And in the end, it just completely takes over. Selfish ambitions, divisions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like. So this is the first lesson tonight. The enemy, this time from the north, and it's tragic. It shouldn't have happened, because Hazor had been raised to the ground in Joshua's day, but because the next generation tolerated the enemy, that's all it took. They just gave them a foothold. The enemy then had a place, and from that place, Hazor was rebuilt, and they grew in strength. I think I've mentioned a few times John Bunyan's Holy War, and you've got the city of man's soul there, which is allegorical of our souls. And man's soul is saved by Emmanuel, and he comes to dwell in the citadel, in the heart, in the castle of man's soul. But then man's soul starts to decline. It backslides from Emmanuel. And what starts it off is, I'll never forget this, it's not the outrageous sins, it's Mr. Carnal Security being allowed to dwell in man's soul. Mr. Carnal Security. Are we too much at ease in Zion? So the enemy, know your enemy. And then the judge that God raises, the judge. The children of Israel cry out to the Lord. And then verse 3 of chapter 4, what does God do? He raises a woman judge, Deborah. She's not just a judge. A judge in this context is a leader, but she's also a prophetess. A judge and a prophetess. Now, if you look at the verses, you may say to me, Pastor, the word doesn't say that God raised her. It says, now Deborah, a prophetess, verse 4, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. Well, yes, but the word doesn't condemn her for doing what she did. And then the most important verse is in the song in chapter 5. She says, after the discouraging circumstances in verse 7, towards the end of the verse, she says, until I, Deborah, arose, a mother in Israel. And that song is divinely inspired. She is a true prophet, not a false prophet. She arose because God raised her up. And there's a lovely description of her as a mother in Israel. Now then, does this jar on you that God uses a woman here as leader and as prophets? Have we got a problem with that? Well, there are a few examples in the Old Testament of prophetesses. Do you know who they are? The first example is before this. In the book of Exodus, you have Miriam, Exodus 15. Then there is later on Huldah, 2 Kings 22, and apparently Isaiah's wife in the 8th chapter of the prophecy of Isaiah. So she was a prophet. She spoke the word of God. And of course, she was also a judge, a ruler. Now, how do we justify this? Because it's quite clear in the New Testament that women are not to be in a position of authority among the people of God. The nation of Israel was a theocracy. It was the church. And now we are the people of God. And God is quite clear. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but it is important. 1 Timothy, this is the most famous passage. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. And then the reason that Paul gives isn't a cultural one. It goes back to the fall. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. And you've got similar words in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Verse 33, for God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. Let your women keep silence in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive. Now, that doesn't mean that women shouldn't speak at all in any meetings, but they shouldn't have a role of authority. They should not be a teacher in that sense, a preacher. So how do we explain what we have in this chapter here? For Deborah obviously was a teacher because she was a prophetess and she was a ruler, and so she had authority. Now, what's the answer? Well, my first answer is this: the exception proves the rule. We've all come across that phrase. The exception proves the rule. Just because there are one or two exceptional cases does not mean that as a general principle, it is right. So we can't use this example in Judges 4 as our reason for ordaining women elders, say, or having women preachers. But, and I need to say this, there are exceptional circumstances. Note my words. There are extreme circumstances where God sometimes does raise a woman to preach. Those of you who are familiar with the Welsh scene will have heard of Antti Meyer. Antti Meyer. She was a preacher of the gospel in Patagonia. She's gone to glory now, but a lovely spiritual lady. And I have no problem with her in exceptional circumstances for years preaching the gospel in Spanish and in Welsh in Patagonia. Now, some will say, but doesn't that mean the men were not doing their duty? We're not told, my friends. Maybe the times had got so bad that men weren't living up to their responsibilities. But what we have to say here is Deborah wasn't part of the problem. She was part of the solution. And in God's economy, there are sometimes exceptions. And we should be flexible enough to realize that there are exceptional circumstances. And we should thank God when he does intervene in such away. But my other answer is this, and I want to concentrate on this. Deborah is given the title Mother in Israel. I think that's the key to explaining the enigma of Deborah, this exceptional case of a woman judge and a woman prophetess. A mother. Here's a quote: just as kings were to be fathers to their people, so Deborah, because she was a woman, was called a mother. She was still a leader, but she was called a mother in Israel. Well, what I find interesting is this: even as a ruler, she still recognized her God-given limitations. So when she commissions Barak, we'll look at that next time, she doesn't do the fighting. She sends Barak. I know she goes with him, but Barak is the one whom God uses to deliver Israel. And so if you look at the Hall of Fame of Faith in Hebrews 11, towards the end of Hebrews 11, in verse 32, where the judges are mentioned, there's no mention of Deborah. It's Barak who is mentioned as the one who delivered Israel. So I think that's a balance there. We're not saying that women, in not having authority, are somehow lower than men. No, we're all equal in the sight of God, but we have different roles. And even as one raised of God to rule Israel in this exceptional period, Deborah still didn't go to the front line. She dwelt further south in Mount Ephraim. The battlefront was north, and it was Barak that was involved in the battle. So I think that's important. Lloyd-Jones in Preaching and Preachers, I think, or is it in Life in the Spirit, his exposition on marriage in Ephesians, talks about a pastor and his wife, and the wife was much more intelligent than her husband, and she didn't want to usurp his authority. So she had a way where she was gently able to suggest certain things to him, and it sounded as if the idea had come from him. I just think that's a lovely example of somebody still trying to recognize the headship of the man. So Deborah as mother in Israel. Another quotation, I like this. There could be no greater contrast between the oppressor and the deliverer. A monster, that Sisera, who held the tribes of Israel in his iron grip, and a mother who led them with a gentle hand. And she judged Israel. And if you look at verse 5 of chapter 4, she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. If they had a problem, if they had a dispute that needed sorting, they would come to this palm tree where Deborah sat under it, and she would help them. A mother in Israel. Isn't God good in providing mothers in Israel? All I want to do now is go through a few examples of mothers in Israel. If you look in the New Testament, look at Acts chapter 18. We have Priscilla, Aquila and Priscilla. Acts chapter 18, verse 26, they met Apollos, a powerful preacher, but they noticed there were certain things lacking in his understanding of Scripture. And we're told, Acts 18, 26, he, Apollos, began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Aquila and Priscilla heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. It's not just Aquila, it's Priscilla, his wife. She was a mother to Apollos. And then we have maybe the most famous example at the end of Romans. Do you know who I'm going to mention? Romans 16. Phoebe. I think it's verses 1 and 2 of Romans 16. I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church, that you may receive her in the Lord in a manner worthy of the saints, and a sister in whatever business she has need of you. For indeed, she has been a helper of many and of myself also. A true mother to the church. The Apostle Paul can say that she was a great help to him. Aren't you glad that God has provided mothers in Israel? I'm trying to get us to understand that there is a vital role for our women in the church. They're not just there to do more menial tasks. They are the center of the church. Some of the closest of our Lord's disciples were women. The men abandoned him at his hour of greatest need when he went to that cross. But the women, they still stood by him. It was the women who were at the tomb before the men. Now, let me just give you a few examples from church history, and then I will finish. How many godly mothers there have been in the church over the centuries who've played a vital role in praying for their children and having a burden for them. Maybe one of the most famous example is Susanna Wesley, the mother of John and Charles Wesley. I don't think those two men would have become the giants, the spiritual giants that they grew into, without Susanna Wesley's nurturing of them. And maybe another famous example is Monica, Augustine of Hippo's mother. She was so burdened for her unconverted son. He was wild. And she persisted in prayer for him and asked God to save him. And God didn't just save him, but she made him into one of the greatest theologians ever. Be encouraged. Mothers, continue to pray for your children. Pray that God would save them and mightily use them in the church. And then, how many godly women, mothers in Israel there have been, who have had no children of their own, but they've had countless spiritual children. It wasn't just in the time of Deborah that people could come to the palm of Deborah and find spiritual counsel. How many palms of Deborah's there have been over the years? How many of you would have gone up to Llanymowdwy and found there John and Mary? Mary, a mother in Israel. They never had their own children, but they had hundreds and hundreds of spiritual children from around the world. Ministers like J.I. Packer and Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones included, being helped by that couple, by Mary. And then some of you will remember Auntie Bessie. She was a great character. How many will remember her fondly from the way she nurtured children in the camps? And then what about elderly ladies in our church? Married, widowed, never been married. I think the last day will reveal how much our churches are indebted to the prayers and the pastoring behind the scenes of elderly ladies. I think they keep the church going in many, many places. And then finally, if you think of the women missionaries over the years, I've just got a list here, but this is just very selective. Isabel Kun, Corrie ten Boom. Who was that lady that was in China? Gladys Aylward. Aren't you grateful for mothers in Israel? I'm sure if God was to visit us in power, not only would great preachers be raised, but that he would also raise those who would nurture the children of God, mothers in Israel. Are we going to pray tonight, not just for our preachers, but for our mothers, for our single women, for God to raise, even amongst our people, mothers in Israel? If you ever go to Llangeitho, underneath Daniel Rowland's statue, that great preacher in the 18th century, you will find this poem. O heaven, 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 thy corners would be sufficiently empty were it not that Zion is nursing for you children upon earth.